This week's mailbag comes to us via email. Dear Lisa, thank you so much for telling me, a mom of kids under age 5, to go take a nap in one of your podcasts. I have 2 biological children with disabilities under the age of 5. You are the first woman I have heard of whom I can look up to and see myself. You don't overshare about what's going on with your kids, but I can hear your struggle in what you don't say. But somehow, after the madness that is their early life, you've managed to build and grow a successful business helping other people. I still have piles of paperwork and stuff from the multiple times we've moved in and out of the hospital over the last few years. But hearing that you've made it to a place of freedom and fulfillment as your kids have aged has given me unbelievable hope. Thank you so much for reminding me that I'm still at a hard stage of life and that it's okay if my house isn't completely organized. Thank you for reminding me that it's okay to rest.
Do you have an organized 365 success story? If so, we would love to hear about it. Please send us an email at customerservice@organize365 and tell us how you have taken back your home, your paper, and your life with Organize 365.
Welcome to the Organize 365 podcast. I'm your host, professional organizer, productivity expert, and motivational speaker, Lisa Woodruff. This podcast will help you embrace progress over perfection and create lasting functional organizing in your home. I have so much to share with you, so let's get started. As we get ready to celebrate Black History Month in February here in the United States, I wanted to share some of the history that I have learned about the differences between Black and white Americans owning houses in the United States. So I have never done anything for Black History Month. I don't do anything for Cancer Awareness Month or any of the special national days here on the podcast. It's just not one of the things that I tend to focus on. But with everything coming to light last summer and how much I dove into the history and the differences between Black and white Americans last summer, I thought that it would be appropriate to share what I've learned about the difference between Black and white home ownership specifically. And I really have been thinking for months about how would we celebrate Black History Month and what would I share here on the podcast. And truth be told, I'm a lifelong learner. I love history. I love to learn about cultures. You heard a few podcasts ago about how recently I've been diving into European history and French history. And now I've just started rabbit trailing into the history of Japan, which I knew nothing about. And I've started listening to podcasts and books about that. I just love to learn about all people all over the world and how it relates to myself, my home, and broadening my horizons. So as I prepared for celebrating Black History Month, and I always learn every February, I thought, what am I being called to share? And I looked online as to, like, you know, what are the parameters for a white woman to share during Black History Month? How can I celebrate that in an authentic and true way? And I came up with many ideas that I thought were just like, one blog post I read specifically said, do not just start highlighting Black people, you know, as if that is going to be Black history. Like, that's not what the point is. The point is the history of the Black population, you know, and celebrating it. And so I thought, okay, great. This is a podcast about organizing your house. So what would be relevant about the history that is different than my history that would be for the African American population? And I thought, you know what? We're organizing our house. What about the difference in home ownership and homes and houses? And how I really realized last summer that one of the ways that white people in the United States have achieved college educations and a lot of what they have today is because they were able to acquire land and increase their wealth through specifically through home ownership. And I did a lot of research around that that I want to share in this podcast. And I'm just going to ask for grace. If I don't say things exactly the right politically correct way, please understand I'm just trying to get more information out. And secondly, this is not a NPR podcast about the history of home ownership for people that are not white in the United States. These are just recollections of the books I read and the thought process I went through last summer as I recognized there was a difference that I didn't realize existed before. The books and the podcasts I'm going to reference, I listened to 9 months ago. So my memory is not always detailed and accurate in real time. So for sure, in recalling from 9 months ago, it's not going to be 100% accurate. I hope that this podcast really brings to light some of what I've learned over the summer and causes you to dive deeper in your own research, not that this is a podcast you would quote if you were writing a research paper. Can we all agree on that? Also, I think the more we know about all of the differences that we all have, I think the better we all are, and the more empathetic we are, and the more we're able to give grace, and the more we're able to make a change. Now, my history of understanding home ownership and land ownership, I now realize is quite unique. And I never realized it was unique because I only knew my story and I didn't know anybody else's story. So my father's family came over from Ireland in the mid-1900s. I'm not sure if they bought or rent their houses at first, but they were Irish Americans and they came to Cleveland, Ohio, and a whole bunch of Irish Catholic Americans, so many family members. And recently, one of those members created like a book. They published a book about the history of our family. And I now know that when they came over, they would keep coming over on the boat, different people from different extended family. And when they got to Cleveland, Ohio, they all settled in the same couple of streets. And so they would live multi-families in one house, and then someone else would get a house, and then people would come over from Ireland and they would live there. But if you were on a street of like 100 people, like 15 of the houses would be my family members, which is really kind of cool. And I didn't know that. But I always knew that my father's family had land and still has land in Ireland, and it was on this little island, and you took a boat to school because my great-grandmother would tell me these stories. And I knew that they had enough money to be in the United States and have jobs, but not a ton of money. I mean, my great-grandmother owned her house, and all the family did very well in the United States, and they came to the United States because of famine and things like that in Ireland to have a better life for themselves. But they were much more of an immigrant family than my mother's. On my mother's family, it's an extremely small Protestant family in which each family member only had like one or two kids in the most recent generations. Like in the last four generations, my grandmother was an only child. Her mother was an only child. My grandmother had two children. They each had two children. So you can see it's a much smaller family than like my dad was the oldest of six. His mom was one of six children. Of those six children, of those six children, like some had like 13 children, or my great-grandmother was one of 13 children, much, much larger family. So on my mother's family side, I'm a daughter of the American Revolution, which means that my mom's family was here before the United States was a country. And I just recently, again, found out that there's actually a house in Boston that is in our family lineage. I also knew for a long time that my grandmother's farm, one of the farms that they had in between Akron and Cleveland, Ohio, was sold to the state and is part of the Ohio State Turnpike now. So growing up, I always knew that there was a farm in our family that is now part of the Turnpike, and there's many other lands that my mother's family always had. And so my mother's family always owned their own houses, and I'll tell you a story about my grandmother buying a house a little bit later in this podcast. So that's my family of origin. My parents have always owned a home. They had a mortgage. When Greg and I got married, I think was when they paid off their mortgage. I only know like a handful of people in my entire life that have ever paid off their mortgage. But for the most of my growing up and adult life, I don't check people's bank register or anything, but everybody in my family bought a home, got a mortgage, and they pretty much live in the same houses for, 20, 30, 40 years. Like they buy a home, it's a family home, they have a mortgage, they live in that house. Not many of my family members that I know in my immediate family rent, they all own. And I just thought that's what everybody did. I have now found out that is not the case. So back in May, June, I guess it was June, when all of the Black Lives Matter things start to come to light and this differences between Black and white Americans' reality, day-to-day reality, became evident. Honestly, I was blindsided, which seems, you know, it seems odd to say that now, but it doesn't seem. Whenever you realize about a diversity and inclusion, a difference issue, the first time you hear about it, if it's not your norm, it does seem different because it's not something that was in your scope of reality before. So next Thursday, we are going to re-air the podcast episode that I did with Milana. Milana is a Miami University college student that is one of our interns that we hired in the spring. And so as all of this came to a light, we had a conversation and we recorded it and we put it on the podcast. And I've since heard, since recording and putting that podcast out there, that my experience and what I was sharing as, you know, a 48-year-old white woman raised in America, always living in America, and the conversation I had with Milana, who is Black, resonated with a lot of you. You said, yes, that's exactly the thoughts I had and exactly how I thought about it. And in presenting this information that I learned this summer, I'll kind of share with you a little bit more about why I held the belief that everyone was homeowners in the United States and why I now know that that is not true. So one of the first things that happened last June and July, as I was becoming more aware of the differences between Black and white Americans, is I had conversations with my Black friends. And I do have quite a few Black friends, and I'm a talker, and I'm an open book, and all my relationships I have are open books. And so there are probably a dozen people that I had conversations with. Some of them, we had ongoing conversations all summer long, as they too were processing the fact that they couldn't believe that people like me had no idea that there was an issue. And so they were starting to realize that, you know, okay, we thought you knew and you didn't care. We didn't realize you didn't know. Like, that was kind of the gist of the conversation by the time we got to August, and some of the heightened emotions have been taken out of the conversations. And one of the first things that someone said to me was, well, you know about Black Wall Street, don't you? And I was like, no. And to be honest, by the time I got to the end of the summer and those dozen conversations, 75% of the Black people I talked to didn't know about Black Wall Street either. So Black Wall Street is interesting. I will say that before 2020, I used to say something was really good if it was held my interest and told a good story and was thought-provoking. I no longer call many of those things good because the things that I used to classify as good would have been like this podcast, Black Wall Street, or the book, The Color of Law, or, you know, the movie, The Banker. I'm going to go through all of those. They were all what I, in 2019, would have called good. And now what I call well done. I now say things are well done because the topic that is covered is not good. There's nothing good about it at all. The fact that it needs to have a book, a podcast, or a movie is sad, but they're very well done. So the first thing I did, I read many books, but I listened to the podcast, Black Wall Street, 1921. And I'm not sure who it's done by, but it's like 10 or 12 episodes. They're very well done, very engaging. I found myself trying to drive more, do more yard work, whatever, so I could continue to listen to the story. Fascinating, eye-opening, and really made me realize that there's a lot in history that I don't know. And possibly why I started diving into the history of Europe and France and all these other things is I started thinking, what else don't I know? There's so much I don't know. So if you also don't know, there was a town called Greenwood near Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the 1900s that was Black Wall Street. It started in 1906. A wealthy African-American landowner named O.W. Gurley, moved to Tulsa and bought 40 acres of land, and he opted to sell it only to Black settlers. So I'm reading this from the CNBC report, Make It, called What is Black Wall Street? Because I want to get as many of these details correct as possible for you. And they say Gurley had been born in Arkansas to former slaves and was mostly self-educated. Believing he was unlikely to experience success in the Jim Crow era South, Gurley left Kansas in the 1890s to join thousands of other homesteaders claiming land, which previously belonged to Native Americans, but was made available by the federal government to westward traveling settlers. Now, I'm going to stop here. What I remember, not 100% accurate because this was 9 months ago, but what I remember when I first started listening to the Black Wall Street podcast was this. There were Black Americans in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and there were Indian Americans in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because of the Trail of Tears. Now, I am very well versed in the Trail of Tears. They must have taught it every single year in school, or it just made a really big impact to me when I heard it, because I know all about the fact that we took the land from Indian Americans and they had to literally walk. So it's the Trail of Tears, where they were walking from Georgia all the way to, I don't know why, I thought they stopped in Tennessee. I don't know why I stopped there. But apparently, they made it all the way to Oklahoma. That's how far they made it. And what happened in the Trail of Tears, which also is not very well publicized, and it's really hard to research and find out, is that those Indian Americans had slaves. And that is how the Black population got to Oklahoma. Because I'm like, what are they doing there? And all of that. So I don't remember if I heard this in the podcast or if I was reading it in a book or it just kind of coalesced in my head and I made it up. I could have made this up, but I'm pretty sure I heard it in the podcast. So O.W. Gurley had 40 acres of land that he owned as a Black American that he sold only to Black Americans. So he was a landowner and he sold to other Black Americans. But also, the reason why there was this land in Oklahoma and why the Indians were there is because the Indian Americans were there is because the federal government had to pay reparations to the Indian Americans that they moved from the land that they owned in Georgia. So they moved them from the Georgian land to the Oklahoma land and they gave them the land. I don't know if it's the same amount of land, more land. I do know that this number 40 acres comes up a lot. So maybe it was 40 acres of land per person. I'm not sure. I haven't done the research on that yet. But what I thought I heard, but now I'm not seeing in what I researched, so I could have imagined it, was that also the Black Americans got that same reparation because they were moved from Georgia to Oklahoma. I could be wrong about that. But that led me to thinking about reparations. And a big conversation in the 80s when I was in school about reparations that should have been paid to former slaves and were never paid. Again, I have not done the research on that, but my thoughts were thinking about that as I heard this story about Black Wall Street. I said, huh, so we moved the Indian Americans somewhere else and we paid them their reparations. And I think reparations were due to Black slaves when they were liberated, but I don't know as those ever got paid. So that's like an open loop. Sorry. Fill me in if somebody knows. So I'm listening to the story of Black Wall Street. Now, this is what is fascinating. So this land became available in 1906, and it was sold only to Black Americans. Now, inside of this Greenwood District, by the time you get to 1920, which is 14 years later, we have many Black Americans living there because they can't buy land anywhere else. They can't get land anywhere else. They can't buy land anywhere else, so they live there. Interesting, they can work. Like they can work other places and they can be employed other places, but once they earn the money in white America, they can't spend the money in white America. Like, for example, if they work in a hotel as a custodian, a white hotel, they then can't book a hotel and stay there overnight with their family as a staycation. Or if they work, you know, in a restaurant, in a white restaurant, they cannot bring their family back there on the weekend and enjoy dinner in the white restaurant as a Black American. So because Black Americans were able to work in white establishments but not patron white establishments, what happened was the Greenwood District got hugely wealthy. And the reason why is because once the money was made in white America, it was spent in the community of the Greenwood District. And there's research to show that for every dollar spent in Greenwood, it was spent 36 times. So what would that look like? Well, first you have to know what they had. So inside of the Greenwood District, they had many entrepreneurs. They had a rooming house, a Masonic lodge, a grocery store, a candy shop, a 750-seat movie theater, lawyers, the Tulsa Star, which was the area's most prominent Black-owned newspaper, a hospital, a public library, and some of the best schools in the area. So imagine you go and you work, let's say, as a custodian at a hotel, a white hotel, and you earn your money and you come back into Greenwood. Then you would go to the grocery store and you would spend money. And then the people that worked at that grocery store would get the money and they would buy a ticket to the movie theater and they would see the movie. And the people that worked at the movie theater that then would take the money over to the candy shop and they'd buy some candy. And then the people that worked at the candy shop would take the money and they might save that. And then they would go to, see what I mean? Like all the money stays inside. So because they weren't allowed to patron white establishments outside of the Greenwood district. And so the money kept circulating inside of Greenwood, making it more and more and more prosperous and extremely educated. You know, doctors and lawyers and hospitals and schools. And I mean, they were getting smarter and more educated and a lot more money and more powerful, obviously, because that's what happens when you have all of those things. And then you'll have to read for yourself what happens to Black Wall Street, because it's too sad for my podcast. It's just horrific, mind-boggling, incomprehensible, happened in 24 hours. Eventually, I'll go back and do even more research than I've already done, because I want to understand how that could have even happened. What happened in 24 hours. Essentially, Greenwood was wiped off the map. Like, it didn't exist 24 hours later. Like, it's hard to fathom. My brain cannot comprehend that happening to a city in America, to a community in America. And also the details surrounding everything in Greenwood is very, you know, they didn't keep a lot of good records because white Americans don't really want you to know the story. And Black Americans didn't really have a way to record what happened or the authority to say what truly happened. We'll never know. We'll never know what really happened. So after listening to that podcast, I thought to myself, okay, if in the early 1900s, the roaring 20s, the Black population, when given land, are just as successful, if not more successful, than the white population, what happened between 1920 and 2020 that we're still having this disparity, that we're still having this inequity? Like, how, if the civil rights movement passed in the 60s and 70s, how come there's still this inequity and this disparage today? So I read some different books, but the one that really impacted me the most was The Color of Law. This was a book I would start to read, and I had it on Audible, and I had to stop because, again, just like with Black Wall Street, I could not comprehend that what I was reading in this book was true, that it was truly what happened in the United States in basically the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and that it was still playing out today, and that I had absolutely no knowledge at all that it ever happened. Like, I just could not believe it. So again, I'm going to read from an article, and this one is an NPR interview in May 17th of 2017 called The Color of Law Details How U.S. Housing Policies Created Segregation, and we'll link this in the show notes as well. So the author of The Color of Law is Rothstein, and the person that is interviewing him is Shapiro. So the interview starts with this idea. This segregation of the United States, the Black and white neighborhoods that you could still see today, really came about in the 40s and 50s. And the reason they came about in the 40s and 50s was because that's when suburbs were created because of the baby boom. And there were laws that were created for the development of homes in suburbs to exclude Black Americans from being able to purchase the land, to purchase the houses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What shocked me to learn is that up until that point, neighborhoods were integrated. I had assumed or thought or somehow come to the conclusion that Black and white Americans had always lived separate. They'd always lived in separate communities. And now we're trying to integrate the two populations together. That assumption and that understanding that I had was false. Black and white Americans used to live together. They used to live in the same neighborhoods. They used to live in the same cities. They used to live together. Now, it probably was similar to, you know, my Irish immigrants, where when you came over and you immigrated, a bunch of you lived on the same street or in the same neighborhood. But there were also Black Americans there. Like there were, it was the city. Like there might have been like one part of the city was more white or more Black or Italian or Irish American or all of those different, all the different Americans had like little pockets within the city, but they were all in the city, right? So it was like, you know, a stone's throw and you would hit another race, another ethnicity, another religion, another whatever. They were all kind of close together. Well, this adding of the suburbs and pulling the white Americans out into the suburbs left a vacuum in the cities. I mean, now I'm speaking just out of turn, I guess. We'll let the experts speak to that. So Rothstein says, it takes many people by surprise. This whole history has been forgotten. It used to be well known. There was nothing hidden about it. The federal government pursued two important policies in the mid-20th century that segregated metropolitan areas. One was the first civilian public housing program, which frequently demolished integrated neighborhoods in order to create segregated public housing. Okay, stop. What? What? Like, this is what I'm saying. They used to be integrated neighborhoods. We demolished those so that we could create separate public housing. So as you're getting ready for the civil rights movement to really come to its full, you know, to get passed in the 60s, leading up to that, we were creating more segregation than actually had been there before, which blows my mind. Second, the second program that the federal government pursued was to subsidize the development of suburbs on the condition that they only be sold to white families and that the homes in those suburbs had deeds that prohibited the resale to African Americans. These two policies worked together to segregate metropolitan areas in ways that they otherwise would never have been segregated. Shapiro asks, the book gives so many different examples of how this played out, and one of the worst offenders is the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. Explain why this one government agency has so much influence over where people live and what the FHA did to prevent Black people from buying and owning homes. And Rothstein says, perhaps the best known example is Levittown, just outside of New York City, but there were subdivisions like this all over the country. What the federal government did in the 40s and 50s is that it came to a developer like Levitt. The Levitt family then built Levittown. The family could never have assembled the capital necessary to build 17,000 homes on its own. What the federal government did, the FHA, is guarantee bank loans for construction and development to Levittown on the condition that no homes be sold to African Americans and that every home have a clause in its deed prohibiting resale to African Americans. In the book, I learned this clause like is in houses that even were sold in the 80s. It's just still in contracts. I was tempted to go look at my home contract. We bought our home in 1995. I haven't yet. Probably because I don't want to know if that clause is actually in there. That paperwork is so long, it might still be in there, and that I just don't even want to believe that it might be in there. Then Rothstein says, we're not talking about the Deep South at all. We're talking about the North, the West, the Midwest. And they specifically mention Ohio in the book, Cincinnati in the book. Again, do your own research, but it is unrefutable that the segregation in neighborhoods that we see today was caused by laws that were passed, lending practices of banks, the stepping aside of police to let Black Americans be intimidated and basically forced out of neighborhoods because they would not step in as they would for white Americans. I now see why there is that anger about police because of what has happened in the past. What I would say about this is I always knew that there were ways that you couldn't get a loan, but I didn't know that you couldn't get a loan because you were a Black American. I told you earlier that my grandmother's mortgage was short in her house. Now, they owned land. Like, my grandmother was raised on a farm, and my great-grandmother, like, even owned a restaurant. They owned a lot of land and a lot of different property. But when my grandmother went to buy a house when she was young and newly married, my grandfather had a heart condition, and they would not loan them money because it was known that my grandfather would probably die young, and he did. He had a massive heart attack when my mom was, 19 or 20. So my grandmother was able to secure a loan of some sort, but they had to pay it off in 3 years. And she told the story of how they would pay off their home in 3 years. So early in her marriage, they owned their home because they had to. There was no other way to get a home. So I knew that. Another thing I had been researching, like maybe a year, year and a half ago, was more about the feminist movement. I never really identified as a feminist or researched the feminist movement in any way. And one of you called me out on that. And you were like, are you a woman? I was like, yeah. You're like, you should know about the feminist movement. Like, do you believe women should have equal rights? Like, do you believe that? And I was like, of course. Like, I own my own business, blah, blah. They're like, look into what the feminist movement really is. And so I started reading books like about Condoleezza Rice and then Hillary Clinton and then Michelle Obama and I learned, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I learned that these women that made it to the top of our political, made it to the top of politics, in order to get there, like, it was super hard for them to go to college. They were the only female in their class. They were the only female in that school. It's just very, very interesting. If you want to explore more, you know, like Condoleezza Rice's story, which is the one I read first, so well done. So interesting. You know, she was there in the Birmingham bombings. Like, some of her really good friends died in that. Again, I'm so bad with the details. This book I read like 3 or 4 years ago. But they would bomb Baptist churches. And some of her good friends died in those bombings, like when she was a young child and her dad was a minister. And the story of her education and how and what they thought about education and how she got to Stanford. And then I'm also fascinated by the fact that so many people that are successful or have connections somehow went to Stanford or connected to Stanford. So I can rabbit trail on anything. But hearing her story, but also hearing white female stories of how hard it was to get through law school or, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's story is fascinating. I mean, fascinating. The woman went to law school and cared for her husband who was sick and her child and did her husband's law work for him. Like, unbelievable amounts of energy. Like, just fascinating. And so as I learned more about the feminist movement and about the story of even white women and how hard it was for women, that's when I learned that even in the 70s, like, and the 80s, you couldn't get a credit card in your name. You couldn't get a mortgage in your name. If you were a single female, not married, like, I could have never built Organized 365 the way I do today if it was the 70s, 80s, or 90s. Like, I go out and I get loans all the time and no one co-signs for me. And that's how far we have come. And so it's so funny. I realized that was a female issue. I didn't realize it was a black and white issue. I know. It seems like, how could you not extrapolate, Lisa? But I just didn't. I just didn't extrapolate. And so maybe you are where I was. So I leave you with this. We got an Apple TV right before Christmas, and I have wanted to see the movie The Banker. I had heard it was a good movie. It's a story from the 60s about two entrepreneurs who basically buy a bank so that they could buy land and they could buy property, and they happen to be Black Americans. And so I wanted to see the movie before I realized they were Black Americans. So Greg and I watched the movie, and as we were watching it, because when I was reading The Color of Law, I would just stop and I would go in and I'd be like, Greg, you will not believe what we did. We, as a country, like, you would not believe. We caused segregation. We did this. Like, and I would just be so amazed. And he would be like me. No, we did not. Like, there's no way. I'm like, no, way, definitely way. Look at this is what we did. And he's like, you've got to be kidding me. Why would we do that? I was like, I don't know why we did it, but we did it. And I just want you to hear, Greg's 54, I'm 48. We did not know. We did not know about the color of law. We did not, I guess I knew about redlining because I had a couple of Black American friends in high school that I would hang out with all the time. And they were saying, yeah, like this neighborhood, that neighborhood. I didn't really understand what they were saying. Like I lived in the country, so I was kind of considered like the hick one or whatever. And they lived more in the city and I didn't know what they were talking about. And now in hindsight, I understand what they were trying to tell me that I couldn't comprehend in the late 80s, also because I was so naive. So I would just say to Greg, Black Wall Street, you won't believe about this. You know, Color of Law, you won't believe about this. Like all the books that I read this summer. And we started watching movies. Like we watched some of the ones many of you probably watched this summer that really showed the plight specifically of the Black American population in incarceration, which I get it. I'm getting it. But this movie, The Banker, is about entrepreneurs. I'm like, yes, a good entrepreneurial story. I suckered Greg into seeing a movie I want to see, you know, because I'm sure I'll learn business practices from this. And basically, it's these two Black Americans in California, and they want to buy property and houses, and they run into a couple problems. It's the 60s, but they're pretty successful until they try to take this to the South. This show that works in California does not work when they go to one of their hometowns deep in the South. And it's just sad. It's very sad. And the way Greg and I would have experienced that movie 1 year prior was like, wow, that's terrible. That shouldn't have happened. And we would have moved on. The way we experienced that movie this winter was we paused the movie crying, and we looked at each other and we said, I cannot believe we let this happen in the United States. I cannot believe that this is and was people's reality. And so I guess I just leave you with that. This is a podcast about organizing your home. And for many, home ownership has not been an option. And now that it is an option, there isn't enough generational wealth for it to be an option yet. And while I do not say you have to own your home in order to organize it, I always say any size dwelling anywhere in the world, rent, own, it doesn't matter. I come to my podcast from the lens of always having lived in a house that was owned by my parents, by myself, by someone, raised around people who also owned their homes, not really understanding the rental industry, not really understanding what it's like to live in a city. I've always lived in a suburb or quasi-country area. And I can't change I could change where I live. I don't want to live in a city. I like living in a suburb. I like having a yard. I like having a dog, all of those things. But I am more cognizant now of my bias, my initial bias of what a house looks like, how a household budget functions. And I offer that to you. Like, what are the biases that you have based on how you were raised and the background and the history that your family has? Maybe think through that. Like, do you know what the housing situation was like for your grandparents, great-grandparents, your families of origin? And maybe if your story is different than mine, then my sharing with you, now you now understand how and why I've always thought the way I've thought. Like, part of understanding each other is knowing each other's stories so that we are more understanding. I tell you what, I have never, never been in a conversation one-on-one with someone else who has a different opinion than mine, where it wasn't a civil conversation and we had a discussion where we each learned more about each other's views and we left more educated and yet still knowing that what unites us is far greater than what divides us. The commonalities we have together are far superior to the few differences that we have. And in a one-on-one conversation, as this has been, you and I, right here in this podcast, like there's not a lot of emotion and anger and judgment and accusations because it's one-on-one and it's a conversation. And that's another thing I took from this summer is that I'm happy to have conversations with all people of all religions, races, economic status, whatever. Like, I love people. I love learning. I love conversations. But when you take something and you try to do it on a mass scale or you try to make a blanket statement, that's when sometimes, always, it's going to get muddied because you can't have one blanket statement or one mass scale thing or one overarching principle that is going to hit every diversity that is out there, right? So next Thursday, we're going to play that throwback podcast. You can listen to the conversation that Milana and I had, which is really good. And then next Friday, I'm going to talk to you about how I have very purposefully created a culture of diversity and inclusion inside of Organized 365. But when I started this company 9 years ago, I didn't start it for racial diversity. I started it for gender diversity, neurotypical diversity. I'll go through all the different diversities that I created Organized 365 with initially and how companies grow from being 1, 2, 3, 10 employees to companies that you see that do reflect the whole world inside of their organization once they reach that Fortune 50 level. I'll see you guys next week.